Martin, Security and Exchange Commission, and David E. Whitmore, Whitmore Management, Inc., here as Cahill Appellant. Mr. Ryan for the appellant, Mr. Roney for the appellate.
Make sure we're on the same page. This is the SEC versus Whitmore case.
Correct. Good morning. May it please the court. Russ Ryan, King & Spalding for the appellant. This court tests the limits of the disgorgement remedy in SEC enforcement proceedings. We submit the district court committed legal error in not following this circuit precedent in the area of disgorgement. Beginning back in 1989 with the First City Financial case, this court has held that disgorgement is meant to deprive a wrongdoer of the illicit profits that are caused by his violation, but it can't be used punitively to take more than the profit that was caused by the violation. Of course, the SEC has a host of other punitive and equitable remedies at its disposal to get more than that, but under the disgorgement remedy, this court's been very clear that the disgorgement remedy can't go beyond the profits that came from the violation. The court's precedents also say that it's...
I thought it was more in terms of ill-gotten gains.
Well, First City Financial certainly talks in terms of profits, and I think most of the other cases do too, and particularly in a case like this where...
You signed a consent judgment in this case, did you not?
We did.
Didn't it say ill-gotten gains?
It did.
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
Yeah.
This court's precedents also say that it's the SEC's burden, not the defendant's burden, to come forth with a reasonable approximation of what the profits were, not the gross receipts from the transactions, but the profits the defendant. And it also says that it's the SEC's burden to distinguish between the legitimate portion of the profit and the illegitimate portion of the profit. We submit that the approach taken by the SEC and the district court in this case can't be squared with First City Financial and this court's subsequent
SEC has produced evidence supporting their position, is it not incumbent upon the defendant to come forward with some refutation if they disagree with the... what is the number you say should have been the disgorgement?
We provided a range within which a reasonable approximation anywhere from 32 cents a share to 50 cents a share.
Counsel, what is the number you say should have been the disgorgement?
We also acknowledge that we would take the low end of that range so that it would be 32 cents a share.
You're saying the court made an error that we should reverse because it didn't come up with a number that you can't come up with yourself.
I don't have a calculator with me.
That's the sense I had when I got through reading your brief.
No, it's 32 cents a share. The difference between 66 cents a share, which was his sales price, and we would take under this court's precedent, the ambiguities and uncertainties go against us. So we take the extreme low end of the range that a reasonable approximation of the profit would be, which would be 66 cents a share minus 32 cents a share times the number of shares that were sold. And I don't remember off the top of my head. I think the SEC said it was something like a million shares. So it would come out to somewhere in the neighborhood of $320,000. But our primary position is that that money, under the SEC's own theory and evidence, flowed into Mr. Cahill's brokerage account and promptly flew out to
a... I'm not sure why that matters. I mean, ill-gotten gains do not cease to be ill-gotten gains because you are sharing them with somebody else.
Well, because I think the difference here is as part and parcel of the scheme itself that's been alleged and that's at issue here, the money ends up with other people. It's not a situation like the what we call the spent money cases, where a person actually ends up after the scheme with money and then spends or squanders it or transfers it to someone else. Here, the very nature of the scheme was that when all was said and done, the money was over with a former lawyer for the SEC who was a prominent corporate lawyer at the time, and to some extent probably with some of his clients.
For purposes of this remedy, why is that any different than if he had immediately taken it and flown to Monte Carlo and lost it all with the
because in your example, the scheme
itself... That's what my clients used to do.
Yes. In your example, the scheme itself actually caused a personal gain to the defendant, and then after the scheme is done, he's free to do what he wants with it. And I agree, if that were the case, there'd be at least a logical basis for saying, well, he can't avoid disgorgement because he spent it on vacations or food or what have you, or even assets.
Is the liability under this remedy several, joint and several?
We contend that that was error too here. There are some courts that have applied it. We spent a fair amount of time in our briefs explaining why in an SEC law enforcement case, the equitable remedy of disgorgement, it doesn't make sense to apply joint and several liability in most cases, particularly where there's no interrelationship between the participants involved. For example, it's not a corporate sub and a parent. It's not a husband and wife. It's not two entities or people where the benefit to one is essentially the benefit to the other. And here, too, the cases also say that if you can easily apportion who got what, which is clearly the case here under the evidence that the SEC presented, the joint and several liability is also not appropriate in those cases because it clearly goes beyond what the defendant himself gained from the unlawful conduct. And we contend that although it may be permissible in some cases, for example, I mentioned if the defendants are very closely related, and most of the precedents are in that category, but here they're two separate entities that don't appear
the
to have any
allegations. And this is a consent judgment allegation. Well, they were acting in concert. Is that not correct?
That's the allegation. Yes.
Yeah. And you entered a consent judgment, right?
Right. There's no, and the district court found that they collaborated, but yeah. We submit that
so
that's.
Why isn't that enough to support the entry of disgorgement against?
I think number one because it would essentially become the rule in virtually any multi-defendant securities case because by nature they typically act to some degree in concert.
Money goes into one of those multiple actors.
Correct.
Why does the SEC have to trace it dollar for dollar out to which actor got which in order to get the disgorgement remedy? Shouldn't that be the expectation of parties who act in concert in violation of the law?
I think to the extent, if this were private securities litigation and there were a harmed party that were seeking to recover losses in the nature of a securities fraud, a tort or securities fraud, that would be different. But disgorgement, this court has said, is specifically not to compensate either the SEC or the investors. There are other ways to do that. But disgorgement is simply to take back from any given defendant what that defendant realized as a result of his scheme. And joint and several liability, while I concede that it's probably appropriate in some cases, this one isn't because there's no relationship between the two defendants, and it was easy and obvious what part of this money went to Cahill on one side and the SEC lawyer and his clients on the other. There's no difficulty
at all. Went to who
else? I'm sorry?
Went to who else?
At least two of his clients.
Back
it looks
up
like
one before that.
Oh, the former SEC lawyer.
How long you been in this case?
I guess, about 3 years.
You still don't know the man's name?
I do know the man's name. I'm just trying.
You know, every time we mentioned him in the brief, it appeared you didn't know his name. You always
thought that was
a former SEC lawyer.
I was just trying
to be decent. You think that somehow makes a difference in our decision that he's a former SEC?
No, not in your. I was just trying to be decent in the public record to.
How many times in the public record did you think you had to put that in your brief before we would get the idea that this was a former SEC?
It was. I can assure you, it was not.
You might ought to look for the man's name and see if you can use it. You wouldn't
Philip
want
Offal.
To think that you're trying to get us to decide a case on improper grounds.
No, absolutely not, Your Honor. I can absolutely, that thought never even crossed my mind. It was truly and.
You truly just couldn't think of his name all those
times. No, it was not that. It was just, I felt like it's a decent thing to do that I don't drag this man through the mud. He's been through enough. I don't even know him, but. Just in my general practice, when I'm saying something negative about someone, it's just my nature to try to use.
Thank you, Jeff.
I can absolutely assure you, it was never in my mind to try to use some kind of subtle semantic game. That I can absolutely assure
you,
Your Honor. Okay.
You're arguing here that there has to be this, or that it. You would prefer this idea that a close relationship is the only time you would have this joint and several liability, but that's actually not the law of this circuit, and the standard here is clear error. So obviously the court doesn't commit a clear error to follow.
Well, I'm not aware of any cases in this circuit that deal with SEC disgorgement in a law enforcement case. That may be the rule in
well,
other types of cases.
Well, you may be right, but okay. In other words, there are some cases out there that say if there's collaboration, then joint and several liability is appropriate.
There are a few cases, although I would say that the vast majority that I've seen actually do have a relationship in addition to collaboration. You're right that the courts tend to say that when they describe the standard, but the cases are few and far between. And as I said in the brief, I'm aware of no case where there was no interrelationship and the apportionment would have been simple and obvious, where joint and several liability was.
Are you aware of any case that goes the other way on that question?
There are a few that we cited in the brief that said where apportionment is easy and obvious, joint and several may not be appropriate.
Okay.
But they're in our brief. Okay. So in terms of the calculation of the disgorgement amount, as I said, First City Financial clearly puts the burden on the SEC, and no case in this circuit that I'm aware of says that the SEC can essentially satisfy that burden by just citing the gross receipts that everyone in the scheme took away from it and then shift the entire burden to the defendant to come forward with something else. Here, the SEC apparently wasn't satisfied with what one would normally have calculated as the profit from this, so they did do exactly that. They proffered the gross receipts that everybody got, and then essentially the court turned the burden over to us. And even though we didn't
what
think...
What did you do when you got the burden?
We essentially relied on the evidence that the SEC had already put in. It's true we didn't put in any ourselves, but we didn't think we had to. The evidence that the SEC had already put in.
Did you ever send a figure to the court as to what it should be, what the number should be?
I don't remember if we ever gave a bottom line figure, but we certainly said it should be 32 cents a share times the number. And if we didn't do the mathematical calculation, that's my oversight. But I don't think there was any dispute that we were willing to live with based on this court's prior rule that all the ambiguities and uncertainties go against the defendant. But we did present a range of stock prices within
I'm
which
not
any...
sure. We may be going way beyond the case, but I think you may be taking us there. I'm not sure where the 32-cent number comes from in the real world in the first instance. What's the origin of the 32 cents a share?
Well, the SEC's expert basically put in all the, there was sporadic trading in the pink sheets in this stock in the 5 weeks preceding the start of the voicemails. And the expert, and we didn't challenge this, I don't think there was any reason to challenge it. Those transactions occurred at 32 cents.
When did your client and his collaborators get their shares?
I believe it was sometime in June or July.
How did they acquire those shares?
They appear to have gotten them from the company itself.
So there's really no evidence that they ever paid 32 cents or anything else for the shares?
There's no evidence about how or why they, no admissible evidence.
There's really nothing there that they expended 32 cents or any other figure, and you came forward with no such figure, right?
Correct, but I would respectfully submit that's their burden, not ours. It was never.
I understand that.
Just to put this in greater context, this was never an issue in the case. The SEC never showed any interest in how, why, or for how much.
This is the issue in the case, is how, what the valuation is of the disgorgement. And you're saying the bottom line figure is 32 cents. You can't now say that's not an issue in the case and get out of it. You came forward with nothing that I can recall that would let the court say that it cost your client 32 cents.
Well, we also said that what he paid for it should be irrelevant in a case where the theory of the case is the stock price was inflated by a fraud.
Thank you, counsel.
Looks like my time is up, but thank you very much.
Thank you. We'll hear from the appellee.
Nicholas Brani, plaintiff appellee, SEC. May it please the court. This is a case about reasonableness, and it presents two issues focused on reasonableness. First, did the district court clearly err in finding that Mr. Cahill's illicit proceeds reasonably approximated his illicit gains? And second, did the district court clearly err, or did it act reasonably in holding Mr. Cahill liable for all the funds that he personally received as part of the pump and dump? Now, in examining both of those issues, it's important to keep four uncontroverted, indisputed facts in mind. First, Mr. Cahill was a central participant in a nationwide pump and dump scheme that involved leaving hundreds of thousands of fraudulent and misleading voicemails designed to pump up the price of TRAE stock. Second, Mr. Cahill received approximately $738,000 as part of the scheme. Third, there is absolutely no evidence whatsoever that Mr. Cahill paid anything for or did anything legitimate in exchange for the shares that he received in this case. And fourth, Mr. Cahill has offered no evidence and no testimony concerning his role with respect to the pump and dump, his role with respect to TRAE, his amassing of TRAE shares, his sales of those shares, or his use of the proceeds from those shares. Now, on the first of the two issues I mentioned earlier, did the district court clearly err in finding that Mr. Cahill's illicit gains or illicit proceeds reasonably approximated his ill-gotten gains? Now, what's a reasonable approximation depends on the facts and circumstances of the case presented. That's essentially the logic that this court set forth in First City Financial, where in deriving the burden-shifting analysis that we use in disgorgement cases, this court explained that the courts and the commission oftentimes encounter imprecise, imperfect, and incomplete information. And that's, of course, a consequence of the fact that wrongdoers like Mr. Cahill oftentimes engage in conduct to obscure their illicit activity and precisely what their illicit profits are. Now, applying that facts and circumstances rationale, the 11th Circuit in Calvo held that where defendants engage in such conduct, like Mr. Cahill did here, district courts act well within their discretion in finding a reasonable approximation based on the more readily measurable proceeds. In other words, where the evidence is difficult to find, is to calculate exactly what their illicit profits are, district courts act well within their discretion in using the more readily measurable proceeds. Similarly, the 9th Circuit in Platforms Wireless explained that where the evidence suggests that profits and proceeds are one and the same, district courts act well within their discretion in calculating illicit gains based on the proceeds. And the facts of that case are actually very important to keep in mind. In that case, the 9th Circuit emphasized that there was absolutely no evidence the defendants had paid anything or done anything illegitimate in exchange for the securities, or that they had some value behind some hypothetical or speculative amount. And the Ninth Circuit emphasized that to the extent any of those three things weren't true, the defendants could easily prove otherwise. The defendants, as in this case, they know what they paid for the securities, if anything. They know what they did for the securities, if anything. And they're closer to the company and have a better idea exactly what those securities would be worth. Now, applying that facts and circumstances rationale to this case, what did the district court know, what did it not know, and what was reasonable based on that? Well, the district court knew what Mr. Cahill received, $738,000. What did it not know? It didn't know what, if anything, Mr. Cahill paid for the securities. There's no evidence in the record that he paid anything. The only evidence in the record suggests that he paid nothing, and Mr. Cahill isn't talking. Similarly, what did he do, if anything, legitimate for the securities?
So it's enough that the SEC meets its burden by showing gross proceeds?
It depends on the facts and circumstances of the case, Your Honor. Under First City Financial, again, this court emphasized that what's a reasonable approximation will depend on the information. And it doesn't mean that in every single case that the commission can meet its burden by showing gross proceeds. In another case where there's evidence that the defendant had paid something or done something or that there was some value beyond some hypothetical speculative amount.
All right, so the SEC knows that and would have to put that evidence in as part of its burden. That's what you're suggesting?
It's, again, it would depend.
If in your hypothetical, suppose you knew that there was a market price out there.
So, for instance, in Belzerian, where it's a New York Stock Exchange traded company, you can go to the stock listing of the daily index and figure out what it is.
So taking that premise, here the SEC knew about the distribution of the funds, did it not? And it knew that you could apportion those funds readily, easily, did it not?
I would actually disagree with both those points.
Those were questions.
On the could we or did we know or could we apportion it or where the money went, there's evidence in the record that Mr. Cahill transferred $549,000 to an IOLTA account. There's no evidence that indicates that's the same money that he was receiving as part of the pump and dump scheme. And in fact, the other defendants who received that 549, or at least may have received that 549, insisted that had nothing to do with the scheme whatsoever, of course, which is why we're not required to trace it, because, of course, Mr. Cahill says, I gave it away, and the other defendants say, we never got it. But we know Mr. Cahill received it. And that's why under Banner Fund, this court emphasized, you stop there. You know what the defendant received. There's no need to go into try and calculate apportionment or anything like that. As to the other evidence that
So the way you're reading Banner is, regardless of what other facts you know, except other than, say, as in Bilzerian, you knew the stock market price, the SEC meets its burden by showing the gross profits.
I think the way we conceptualize it is two different steps. One is the step calculating the actual illicit gains, and then the second step of who got the money. And on the who got the money, we know the answer. It's never been disputed. Mr. Cahill got the money. Mm-hmm. The question of calculating or coming up with a reasonable approximation, that's that first issue that depends on the facts and circumstances. Now, I guess it's possible that even in allocating the money, it could depend on the facts and circumstances or information. There is one Ninth Circuit case where there was evidence of a pre-fraud agreement that required sending the money elsewhere. But again, there was evidence. And in this case, despite the fact that Mr. Ryan just emphasized that Mr. Cahill was giving the money away or that he was required to give the money away, he's offered no evidence of that. He actually can't make that assertion because his client didn't testify.
Oh, he did. He made that assertion.
I would argue that the court should disregard that.
He may not be supposed to, but he can't make the assertion.
Because there's no evidence here. And again, we asked him. He had the opportunity to testify. We deposed him. He took elected to assert his Fifth Amendment privilege. Now, once the district court found that the commission had met its initial burden, Mr. Cahill was given the opportunity to rebut that approximation. Now, he contended that he had a pre-fraud interest in the securities involved in this case. The case law establishes that a wrongdoer may receive an offset for two things, either what they pay for a security or the pre-fraud value of the security. On the first one, again, he's produced no evidence that he paid anything or did anything legitimate for the securities in this case. On the second point, he argued that TRAE had a pre-fraud value between 32 and 50 cents, but as Judge Santel pointed out, he never gave the district court an actual figure. And the district court actually, in the disgorgement hearing, emphasized that Mr. Cahill had failed to give it an actual figure. Instead, they asserted the 32 to 50 cents based on a declaration from Mr. Lowry, who was the commission's expert on disgorgement. And Mr. Lowry...
Why shouldn't the court have gone with the lower number in that range rather than a zero?
Sorry?
Why should not the court have gone with the 32 cents, the lowest number in the range, rather than with a zero?
Because, Your Honor, there's nothing to support that 32 cents as being a fair market value. And there are a couple of things that show that. One, if Mr. Cahill wanted to make the argument that that was fair market value, Mr. Lowry was in the courtroom at the disgorgement hearing. Mr. Cahill could have asked him, did that 32 cents a share, did that represent fair market value? And it's also important to remember that 32 cents a share range, that last trade occurred on August 6th. So we're talking a couple of weeks or a week so prior to the pump and dump scheme. And that number is based on just 22,200 shares changing hands in an entire month prior to the scheme. And Mr. Cahill asserts, if you accept his argument on the 32 cents, that he could have sold these some 1 million plus shares that he sold in this case for exactly that same amount. It's simply unreasonable to assume that when only 22,200 shares are reported changing hands, he could have sold 1 million plus for that exact same number. And he didn't offer any evidence that he could. If he'd offered evidence, again, this might be a different case, but he's not talking.
We all understand that.
There's also other evidence to indicate that that would not be a fair market value. For one, at the same time, those, or approximately the same time, those 22,200 shares are changing hands. There's evidence in the record that Mr. Cahill himself is amassing 1.2 million shares for absolutely no payment whatsoever. There's also evidence in the record that others are amassing substantial amounts of shares, again, for absolutely nothing whatsoever, for some figure, nominal figure well below the 32 to 50 cents range, or for performing de minimis services like opening a bank account. And again, he's offered no evidence to link those up or argue why the district court should have only paid attention to the 22,200 shares. Another important fact to keep in mind is this is not an actively traded security. This is a company that Mr. Cahill had just created. Again, just 22,200 shares. He asserts he could have found buyers for 1 million plus shares. He, again, put in no evidence. On the second issue, which is the Banner Fund issue, it's black letter law in this circuit and every other circuit to consider the issue that when a wrongdoer receives illicit gains, he's liable for everything he receives. The district court simply applied that logic, and it did not clearly err in applying this court and other courts' precedents. Unless there are any other questions.
Seeing none, thank you, counsel.
We would argue the district court acted reasonably and should be affirmed.
The appellant had used all its time, his time. We will give you back 2 minutes for rebuttal. If you want it, you don't have to take it. Appellant. You're appellee, he's appellant.
Thank you.
Go ahead, Jeff.
On the Banner Fund case, I could see that there's some troubling language in that from my position. In the brief, I did point out that we think that's distinguishable. That's a case where there was no dispute that the defendant actually received benefits, and all he was saying basically was, well, it used to be in this pocket, and now it's over here, and I can't get into this pocket. It was his money, and although the language is helpful to the SEC, I really think the facts of the case are substantially different. On the issue of what Mr. Cahill paid for his stock, I think the primary disagreement we have here is whose burden of proof this is. It's the SEC's burden to prove a reasonable approximation of the profits. It submitted some evidence, and we just went with the evidence that it put in on it. That's where we got the 32 cents and the 52 and the 50 cent range. There were 5 weeks worth of trading both before the voicemail scheme, and then even if you look after the voicemail scheme, the stock price stayed in the 40 cent range, and it never got below about 25 cents for the next year and a half or so. It's inconceivable that the voicemails that went on for 6 weeks managed to pump the stock up both before and after. It just doesn't make any sense.
If not, then what happened?
I don't know, but it's...
You imply in your brief that this voicemail scheme couldn't work.
That it what?
That it couldn't work. It looked like it worked.
This is a little bit... I mean, there was some evidence in the record of this, but if you look at what actually happened with this company, Guidry and the company were pumping out press releases, and there was a whole separate other group of people doing the spam faxes and all this other thing. I really can't. The SEC, after 2 or 3 years of investigation, found two people who
said the pump and dump scheme worked. Now, maybe the telephone calling part of it was just one part of it, but unless your client and his collaborators thought it would work, why did they do it?
Well, to be honest, to be technical about it, the complaint never even alleged that my client knew there was going to be a fraudulent scheme. All it says is he hired someone to promote the stock, and it doesn't even allege that he knew it was going to be a fraudulent one. In fact, the fact that there was Mr. Offal involved, who at the time was a prominent securities lawyer, that, in my mind, negates any suggestion that he thought he was doing something that would get him in trouble with the SEC.
You're past the liability point, of course.
But I really do think it comes down to whose burden is it to establish all these things? And are we entitled to rely on the evidence that the SEC itself put in?
I talked to you well past the end of your rebuttal time, so the case will be submitted.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel.